Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, stop. Right on.
Brother, there's far too many of you die.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Hey, Sandy, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. I watched the game last night. That put me in an upswing mood. I was thinking about it. I'd probably watched almost every Packer game that's been on TV since I was a kid, and I realized that I probably wasted a lot of time. But
you know, Sandy, I'm looking at... I think I've got a guest on right away this morning. Can you check that, Connor, and see who that is? Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure I've forgotten. Hang on. But go ahead, Sandy, while we're...
So, watching the Packers, Rodgers can still say he owns the Bears, and it looks like the Packers do, at least. I think last night it had a lot more to do with the running backs and the offensive line actually performing, and then the Bears being the Bears. Apparently it doesn't matter who they have as coach, offensive coordinator, or quarterback. They still possibly get on the wrong track.
You know, Sandy, the Bears, I knew what the outcome was going to be.
I know you said this last week, and I was mocking you for being so positive about it.
Okay, so Sandy, let's go.
Do we have a guest?
Yes, we do. From Boston, all the way from Boston, Mr. Gene G.
Godolas.
Godolas. Mm-hmm. Hey, Mr. Godolas, how are you doing, sir?
I'm very well, Earl. Thank you.
All right, so you want to talk about the Inflation Reduction Act?
I guess I do. Yeah, or we could talk Packers.
Well, so you are the CEO of World Energy, North America's only commercial scale producer of sustainable aviation fuel. You believe that the IRA will result in robust U.S. investment in clean fuels, spur energy independence, and support the creation of American manufacturing jobs.
Mr. Godolas, this is Sandy Williams. I'm real interested in the renewable aspect. Is this a biologically based fuel? What is the fuel?
Yeah, so sustainable aviation fuel is jet fuel made from inputs that you would make biodiesel or renewable diesel from. So animal fats, used cooking oil, vegetable oil, the organic inputs.
Yeah, so French fries fly our plane.
That's right.
Yeah,
you cool. Got it.
Yeah.
So how successful has this been? How much research is going into this?
Into making fuels from something other than fossil fuels?
Yes.
Yeah, quite a bit. World Energy's been around 25 years. We started as a biodiesel producer, have evolved over time to produce other fuels that are low in carbon, sustainable aviation fuel being one of them. But, how much research has been done? A ton. How much research continues to be done? Even a ton more. If I can give you a sense of where this is all heading, it's interesting stuff. We're now working on making hydrogen from nothing but wind and water. And when I say working on it, I'm saying investing millions of dollars into being able to take wind power. The wind pushes
Yeah.
Which is another way to store
energy out of windmills, huh?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Right.
And so that's just one of many. But the Inflation Reduction Act that was celebrated at the White House last week and signed into law a couple of weeks ago had these provisions for climate provisions that are really going to be pretty substantial, not only in the U.S. but around the world in terms of driving who's going to get the jobs out of energy transition. Whether it's green hydrogen or sustainable aviation fuel or fuels for decarbonizing transport on the road, any of it. So it's a pretty big moment. Sometimes we lose the sense of scale of these moments when we're fighting about other more foolish things.
You know, I've often had this question in my mind. I don't think I've ever had someone who on the air or that I've. I'm talking to that can answer it, but it seems to me that extracting oil and gas from the ground is particularly unlabor intensive, and that the notion of deriving energy from something that's more labor intensive would have more of a sort of a middle class growth implication to it. Is your form of energy more labor intensive than extracting oil from the ground and refining it?
Yeah. You know, I wish I had an expert to ask that question, to be honest. Look, there's a lot of jobs in the oil and gas sector. Most projections that I have seen is that the energy transition, as we move to types of fuels that are less carbon intensive, they will actually generate more jobs.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you for sure is this. We are going to transition, not overnight, but we are going to transition away from carbon-intensive fuels, and we're going to move towards less carbon-intensive fuels. And if we want to go where the jobs are going to be growing, we want to be moving in the direction of where the transition is going. If we want to try to, you know, I thought it was pretty heartbreaking to see the promises made to coal producers, particularly in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Appalachia, that we were going to go back to heavy coal production. Well, we're not. That's not going to happen. And no matter how big a political issue we're going to make of that, that's not the future of energy in America. So if we want to go where the jobs are, we have to go where the future of energy is. And that future of energy is in lower carbon intensive fuels.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about on the air, my concern about our form of democracy is that it seems to be mired in the status quo because that's where all the voters are, and there aren't enough voters vested in the future. But the things like what has just passed with respect to pursuing renewable energy is the pursuit of the future, and it's sort of striking out in the right direction, maybe contrary to the winds, because I think that those promises of jobs for the coal miners was a reflection of that status quo, right? You want to talk positively to the people who are currently voting, and here you are carrying the portfolio for the future, which is really where the jobs all will lie.
I think so. I'm not a political scientist. I don't know why one party appeals in one way, another party appeals in another way. But I do know this. I do know that the world is irreversibly moving in the direction of lower carbon fuels, and coal is the highest carbon of all carbon fuels. So, you know, if you're really trying to help generational shift, if you're trying to drive economic viability over time, you've got to be, whatever region you're in, you've got to be going towards where the jobs are going to be in the future, not where they might have been in your father's, your grandfather's era.
You know, Mr. Godolis, Sandy and I were talking about it earlier this morning, as before we even came on the air, that we're not going back. I mean, we have to stop trying to get the American people to believe that we're going to go back to bygone days in this society. And it's just not going to happen. It doesn't make sense. The world moves forward. And so those of our generation, mine and Sandy's, you know, we've got to accept that. You know, it's a new world. It's headed in a new direction, and we can't hold on. And right now you see the debate going on with Joe Manchin. There were some promises made to him by Chuck Schumer, apparently, to get him to agree. And now all of a sudden the pushback is happening. There are people on the left who are saying, we don't care what you and Chuck Schumer talked about. We're not going back to those days of coal miners and black lung.
Well, I think our guest is actually saying something different, which is there's more promise in the future than there is in the past, and that the problem is to get people to believe in the future. And you know, there's so many the symptoms of the future are troublesome to some people because it's not all about economics. The future involves instability in a variety ways. And so maybe America just has faltered in its capacity to more see clearly that the future is better than the past. But
yes, Sandy, I think to your question earlier about the jobs associated with low carbon fuels, and there's all kinds of different low carbon fuels, right? We work in biofuels and now moving increasingly into low carbon hydrogen fuels. But so these are all liquid fuels. But there's wind, there's solar, there's all kinds of other forms of low carbon energy. But to your point, these industries create good quality jobs. And they're good quality jobs for folks that don't necessarily have a 4-year college degree. And they're good quality jobs that the middle class can drive middle class wages that work for families.
And also these jobs can be located not where nature accidentally placed oil, but these jobs can be anywhere that there are these kinds of industries capable of being conducting themselves, right?
So let me ask both you guys, because the pushback on that is always going to be from many elected officials who right now are benefiting by the way, you know, the energy that we are dealing with now with you know, coal and certainly with fossil fuels. Let me ask you, Mr. Godolis, is there pushback from those areas that right now are benefiting from fossil fuel and all those things?
Well, we've got a big operation in Texas, and we're investing heavily in Texas. Yeah, I don't think you can find a place that's more integrated into the fossil fuel economy than is Texas. But Texas is also the state where there's more wind production than any other state in the union. So I think Texas in particular has done a phenomenal job of continuing to feed the country the fuels that it needs as it begins to position itself for the fuels of the future. I was just on a call earlier this morning with a big business colleague down there that their business is natural gas pipeline, and we were talking about new ways to create low carbon fuels at our facility in Houston.
Well, and of course, hydrogen will get moved around in pipelines, right? So that there's
it sure will. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of this existing infrastructure is going to be used. We operate in Los Angeles. We operate a refinery that used to be an oil refinery, and now it makes 100% sustainable aviation fuel from these renewable inputs. We move hydrogen by pipe in and out of that facility. We move clean fuels in and out by pipeline, all of which the infrastructure, all of which was built for fossil fuels, and now it's been repurposed.
With respect to the jet fuel you're talking about, I mean, it still is going to be a contributor of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, but I take it its renewable quality is that the way you're creating it is also got the is a carbon sink, that it's also using carbon dioxide in the generation of the creation of the fuel that then, when burned, will put it back in the atmosphere. Is that the way this works?
Yeah, that's right, Sandy. I mean, there's nothing wrong with nature causes carbon to get emitted back into the atmosphere. Right. Anytime a tree falls over and dies, carbon's going back up into the atmosphere. The problem isn't that the natural cycle is that a tree growing will suck in CO2, and when it dies, it'll emit the CO2 back. Is that man has dramatically impacted the balance between those two things.
Well,
so
yeah,
because we're more and more.
Yeah, that oil is trees that fell down a million years ago. So the synchronicity of the oil, of the CO2 creation and use is no longer there with oil.
Let me ask you, Gene. Gene, you have to go?
Okay.
Okay, so we've got to go to a break. If you'll hang on. We've got to go to a break. On the line, Mr. Gene Gadolis. And we'll get to who he is on the other side. We're running out of time. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
What a fool believes he sees.
Ohio University. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams and our guest is Mr. Gene Gabolius. Sir, how do we pronounce your name?
Out of the way early, huh? It's Gabolius.
Gabolius. Yeah. All right. All right.
Yeah.
So thank you. And you have created Lead the World Energy, pushing the boundaries of innovation into new low-carbon fuel markets and collaborating with leaders of change to address the world's growing energy needs with simple, clean, and renewable solutions. He holds a Master's in Public Administration degree from Harvard University and Bachelor of Science degrees in Economics and Business Management from Ohio State University. Sandy?
No, the Ohio State.
The University. Ohio State. Yeah.
Thank you, Sandy. I appreciate you getting
the... Actually, and it's the Harvard University, too, I believe, in my parlance at least. So Gene, so you're currently up and operating and selling jet fuel, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We've been doing it since 2016.
And do you sell it? I mean, obviously, jet fuel is a commodity. Are you able to sell it at the commodity price, or are airlines paying a premium to get the renewable quality that you sell?
So that's a great question. We introduced the product at par value to jet fuel pricing. It is pretty clear now that there's a demand for low carbon fuels. There's a recognition that low carbon fuels are not the same thing as higher carbon alternatives, and so you've got limited supply and strong demand, and so with that dynamic, we sell it at above the price of jet fuel.
But yours is low carbon just because of this offset quality to it. I mean, what's happening when you burn it is the same, but what happens when it's created is different. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you're not. We got into this before the break about the life cycle analysis on fuels, and the problem is that as you were pointing out, Sandy, is that you're pulling up carbon from billions of years ago and emitting it. When you're using a renewable resource, you're not pulling that old carbon, if you will, out of the ground.
Well, that's great. So now with the hydrogen fuel, you're embarking in a different angle. I mean, I suspect hydrogen can be used in batteries. It can be burned directly and transported around. Is that where you're embarking next in terms of where you're moving your attentions?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of promise in hydrogen. We're going into hydrogen in two different avenues, making hydrogen from renewable natural gas. So you're actually capturing methane from agriculture, animal agriculture, and cleaning that methane up and then making that into hydrogen, which then, as you say, can be used directly to generate energy. It's a backbone for many other products. And so we can reduce the carbon footprint of from all kinds of different products. So, yeah, we're developing that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we're moving in the direction of generating hydrogen by splitting off the H from the 2O in water.
Mm-hmm.
It's an energy-intensive process to split oxygen from hydrogen. But if you're using a renewable resource like wind, then you're generating essentially carbon-neutral fuel.
You know, what's interesting to me, Mr. Golis, is the extent to which the deniers of climate change today frequently are sort of the business community, and at least some of them are the business community that would fashion themselves, I suppose, as conservatives. When to hear you speak and to hear others talk about the future with respect to dealing with climate change, it's really all about capital investment and capital investment opportunities. And so it always surprises me that the people who want to resist the notion that there is climate change are the very people that if they opened their eyes would realize that there's all kinds of business opportunity if they embrace the notion of moving in the direction of compensating for it. I mean, you're one of those people, right? You're finding business opportunity in this whole space.
I couldn't put it any better. You know, the buggy whip business isn't that great.
Exactly. I've talked about buggy whips in the past.
I mean, we've got to make payroll every Friday. We're a business. We've got to make money.
Uh-huh.
And we've got to continue to innovate. And we've got to continue to generate products that we can sell at a price level that is higher than the cost of making it. If we can't do that, we won't be in business. We won't be of much societal use. I think the products that we're developing are very important to society. I think it's very important that companies are out there taking the risk to develop products that don't exist yet, where there are no industries yet. Others will follow. General Motors didn't cause the revolution in electric vehicles. A little company nobody had ever heard of called Tesla did. It's important that there are companies that are out there at the front end of innovation. But, yeah, I think from a purely economics point of view, from a capitalist point of view, any business needs to be out in terms of in front of where the markets are going. And any business has to add value. If you're not adding value to the customer, you're not going to be around.
So, yeah. Mr. Gabolis, I want to thank you. I mean, where else can you hear two Harvard guys early in the morning on Monday going at it?
Well, it can put you back to sleep, I suspect.
Hey, Mr. Gabolis, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Good time.
It's been a lot of fun, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Monday. It's Monday with Mondays with Sandy Williams, a Harvard discussion at 8 o'clock in the morning. We'll be right back.
I used to skip lectures in college. I hope they don't skip this.
Show at 844-967-2789. You can either call or text us. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And listen, man, we go from the Bears to a conversation that's on a level that Harvard grads and Connor understand. But the rest of us, Sandy, try to walk us through
I thought this fellow, like Bullis, I think he's a very interesting. He's got a very interesting business. He's obviously a very smart, able guy, and you know what he's talking about is creating jet fuel. Now, jet fuel is currently refined out of oil, and oil is carbon fuel that has been created by. Trees and other carbon things that were buried underground millions and millions of years ago. So that green stuff was using up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere millions of years ago. And now what we're doing is we're taking it out of the ground, burning it, and putting carbon dioxide back in the atmosphere now. But it's essentially adding to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If we created that fuel out of trees that are growing now, then the effect is more or less the same as the farmer who tills his land. Because, you know, when you're growing hay during the season, or you're growing corn during the season, it's using up carbon dioxide with its processes of, you know, the chlorophyll and the process of plants growing uses CO2 up and puts oxygen out. And so when you till when you pick the corn and now you till all that corn stuff, it now starts emitting the carbon dioxide that it was absorbing during its lifetime. And so you end up with essentially a zero carbon dioxide effect from farming, okay? And that's what this guy is proposing to do with jet fuel. It is the same sort of thing. He's going to take existing carbon sources, ones that are growing currently, and we've turned them into oil for French frying or whatever. Now he's going to take that oil and convert it into jet fuel.
But if he can convert it into jet fuel, can they somehow convert that into gasoline?
Oh, well, you can convert it to diesel fuel.
Yeah, okay.
And you know, ethanol that we burn in cars is created out of corn. So, yeah, you can create fuel that can be used in combustion engines, but you know, it probably is better to figure out ways to even do it more. For instance, electricity that's only partially created by carbon fuel and is also created now in increasing amounts from renewable fuel will mean that if you fire the car up using electricity, you're going to be using less carbon-emitting fuel than you would if you used all carbon-emitting fuel. And the fact is that burning emits carbon dioxide. You know, you can the purer the fuel you burn, maybe the less carbon dioxide you emit, but burning natural gas emits carbon dioxide.
So, Sandy, before we chase everybody away who's just getting up and having their coffee,
Well, we should go back to talking about the bears.
We don't want to go back to talking about the bears, but what we can start talking about, Sandy, is where we are with this economy. And, you know, you and I were talking off the air about, you know, recession and inflation and the stock market and supply. All of these things, Sandy, right now, where there's some people saying we're in recession, and I'm just going again from a layman's perspective on what used to happen when we were in recession when I was a young man, and I know people would get laid off, they'd be on unemployment, it could last anywhere from a year or more, and people would be struggling to pay their bills, and everything would slow down in the economy. And where are we at? We're not seeing. I mean, you know, people are still buying cars. Back during the times when I saw a recession and it impacted and affected myself and others like me who were in industry. Last thing we would be doing is buying cars.
Well, I think the way we got into that discussion was talking about how words matter.
So yes.
And I think I'd like you over this period of this morning show at least to talk about words and how they matter in a variety of ways. But for instance, the word recession matters, because what is a recession? And it's, you know, it's something that's formally defined, and it's, but however informally it's defined in a variety of ways. The most common way that it's been informally defined is that you have two succeeding quarters in which the GDP of the country shrinks, and that's a recession. But recession is really something that is felt in the economy and is felt by Tom, Dick, and Mary, and a recession really only matters if you're feeling it. If something's called, right. If something's called a recession, but the general economy is doing fine and so are Tom, Dick, and Mary, then hooray for the recession, you know?
Right.
And so the question is, do we have a hooray for the recession going right now, or do we have a real problem in the offing? Do we have storm clouds that suggest that we're all going to feel a pinch? If the stock market has a correction, as they call it, but if Tom, Dick, and Mary don't experience it, and if the general economy doesn't experience it, then, you know, so be it. We didn't really experience anything like the prosperity that the stock market experienced during this rise up now into the 30,000 rarefied atmosphere, the stratosphere. And so if it sinks back to 21 or 22,000, I mean, I'll feel badly. I have money in the stock market. But it's not the kind of problem that an across-the-board recession is. So are we headed to an across-the-board recession, even if we are going to have a stock market correction? And that's a bigger question mark, because this recession seems to be caused primarily by exogenous, extrinsic, external forces, shortages that have been caused by the pandemic, shortages that have been caused by the world trade conflict that we set in place with China several years ago, and that have been set in place now with the war in Ukraine. And these shortages are something that will cause prices to go up as money that's out there bids to buy the things that are in short supply. But is that the kind of inflation, if it's going to be cured by curing the supply problem, that is actually going to lead to a dire economic condition? And the stock market is currently predicting that no. You know, if you look at what the long-term, the forecasting that's going on from the financial community seems to suggest that they think interest rates are going to go up in the short term, but that in the long term interest rates are going to drop back down again. You could say, well, they think that because they think the economy is going to sink, or you can say that they think that because they think that these shortages are going to get cured and inflation will then therefore recede. And the way the stock market is behaving goes along with that second scenario, because they seem to think that earnings are going to be sustained, and that rather that this inflation increase, which damages the dollar, a value of the dollar in the future, is going to recede again.
So Sandy, the definition again of recession, two straight quarters of negative.
Well, incidentally, that isn't the formal, and I can't even tell you what the government's formal definition of it is, but the informal, the more generally prevalent economist definition of a recession is two quarters in a row where the gross domestic product decreases.
So I want to attack it from the perspective of the impact that it has on the people who, you know, stocks and all those things, and the impact of people who don't have stocks, mm-hmm. Which is the majority of the nation.
Yeah, and that's what I want to focus on. Is
right.
But the stock market is suggesting that they think that this inflation is going to be short-lived when shortage is solved. One of the reasons that the GDP has probably shrunk is the fact that shortages have made it hard for producers to produce more goods. And so if you adjust the GDP for the measurement of GDP for inflation, and you simply look at the numbers of units of output of things, the numbers of units of output have not been able to sustain themselves. There have been fewer cars produced recently than there were in the past, and that's because of the shortage of chips and some other things that have created this shortage. So I think the generally prevalent view is that when the shortages are cured, production levels will go back up, and meanwhile, jobs haven't been displaced very much because, quite frankly, the producers are busily out there looking for more workers. Most producers will tell you that they're short of workers right now. So that as the beginning of the recession hits them and they begin to shrink in their production, they don't need to lay workers off because they're already short workers.
So, Sandy, the average Joe, you know, me. What is it, John Q. Public or Joe Q. Public?
Which I think one? It's, well, I think we need to come up with a neutral.
Right.
Some
okay.
kind of neutral name.
Right.
I'm not ready for that. Maybe Chris.
Yeah, but from the perspective of
Chris
the
Q.
Average,
Public.
The average person. Mm-hmm. Here's a prime example. I bought a Hostess cupcake today, right?
Oh,
okay,
my.
Okay, so now.
That could have been on the shelf for 10 years.
Not only could it have been on the shelf for 10 years, I took it out, and the size of it is half of what it used to be, in the size of it, yet it's $2.39.
Oh, for God.
And so the average person mm-hmm. in the society right now is looking at this, and he says, hey, I paid $2.39 for that. I used to be able to get an entire breakfast for $2.39. And now I'm seeing all of these things happening. And my dollar is not stretching. And now, politically, mm-hmm. it's used as a football with the Democrats are responsible for this recession. And the Democrats are responsible for why inflation is where it is. And so what I'm trying to say, Sandy, is so the average American is really going to be hurt by this, like you said, people who are in the stock market doesn't really matter. Their bottom line is not going to be impacted and affected, as the average person who is struggling right now to pay their rent, to pay their cable bill, to if they have an automobile. To keep it afloat and running, these things are monumental.
Absolutely.
To them.
So, I mean, there is a recession impacting us, and it's impacting people who are maintaining their employment status. As we talked off the air, you know, 30 years ago when there was a recession, people got laid off, and they experienced, you know, during the 70s when we had stagflation, there was this horror of people being laid off and having runaway inflation in the economy so that they were laid off and all these prices were going up. Now we've got people who are working. There is some impetus in the economy for wages to go up because there is the shortage of workers. So the people looking for workers are having to bid the price of workers up, right? They're having to pay more to get people to do the work that they want them to do, so that the pain of this recession, while it is painful, is not as painful as it would be if there were layoffs associated with it. Now, one of the things about inflation that causes me to worry more than maybe Wall Street is worrying about it is that the inflation to date, people were able to point at oil prices and say that's what's driving it up. Okay, well, oil prices have been going down now, and the fact that oil prices have gone down in the last month did cause the inflation numbers to go down somewhat, but they didn't go down as much as the oil prices went down, and that's because inflation has continued to occur in other parts of the market basket that is measured to measure the consumer price.
So, Sandy, hold the thought. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. You can join us. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Monday. So for my co-host, Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, it's certainly going to play a major role in the election, depending Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Depending on what side of this you're on. So when you see people who,
the polling data would suggest that people are getting a little more sophisticated about blaming good news or bad news on the administration, business good news or bad news, because the polling data hasn't been as sharply reflective of, or hasn't reflected as sharply the kind of inflation that we've begun to experience, and the voters seem to be thinking about more issues than simply that, even though it's clear that inflation is having a fair amount of impact, and it's going to have a fair amount of impact on Tom, Dick, and Mary, and it probably will have a significant impact, most significant impact on the voters who have less than, who are in an income level below the median level in the country. And those voters probably are more predominantly Democrat than Republican.
You know, Sandy, so you have to look at all of this from the prism of the way the society is set up with those who are fortunate, and what percentage of these of the nation can get beyond all these things because they're fortunate to have resources that will sustain them throughout anything. And then there's another level of people who, you know, own a home and have a little saved, and they can withstand these types of things without, you know, struggling, you know, because they've been able to at least live the American dream. Then there's another segment of the population that works every day, is struggling and doing all that they can. They don't understand the process, but they know they're Americans, and they know that they're just trying to make it day to day. And then there's another segment of the population that is just not even counted, because it's just day to day for them. And so when we talk about elections and voting,
well, you know, day to day, though, an awful lot of America lives paycheck to paycheck, which is almost like living day to day. And people who live paycheck to paycheck are profoundly aware of and affected by material inflation.
But if I'm living paycheck to paycheck,
at least you have a paycheck, right?
Yeah, and I live in a suburb.
Yeah.
I'm not doing too bad, but if I'm living paycheck to paycheck and I live in the ghetto, that's a whole different ball game. I don't have anything. I don't own anything, and so I have no value, no worth. Mm-hmm. And so these things impact and affect people on that level who still vote, right?
Right.
There are people who are in that kind of situation who still vote. And so I'm talking about that group of people who really, when we talk about deciding elections.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the cruelties of inflation. And it doesn't take a capitalist society to have inflation. Plenty of either communist or socialist countries have also had inflation. And inflation is just a situation in which the dollar or their currency that's being used to buy things has become diminished in value, or the things that are being bought are in such short supply that they get bid up in price. Either one is painful, and the problem with inflation in every sort of socioeconomic environment is that it's most painful to Tom, Dick, and Mary. So, it's most painful to the people who are living closest to the bone economically.
So let's talk about the fact that the holidays will soon be upon us. And the holidays mean the same for people who have money or who don't have money. And I happen to know and be around a lot of people who really don't have money, who, when the holidays come, they really, these prices are going to be a lot higher, and people are going to struggle even more so to try to live up to what the holidays stand for. And inflation is going to just really destroy it. their bottom lines.
Well, like I said, inflation is cruel. And one of the problems with inflation in every economy is when you try to deal with it, you have a couple of ways to deal with it. You can try and solve the shortage, which the government could undoubtedly focus some attention on, and the general marketplace is madly trying to do that, or at least most of it tries to solve for it.
So why would they when they can keep the inflated prices? Why would they?
Well, because the stimulus for anybody who's selling a product, if I'm selling a product and its price goes up, I want to sell more of those products.
Yeah, but then the price is going to come down the more.
Well, but if you don't control the marketplace, you want to make more of them while the price is up, because you know the price is ultimately going to come down, but you want to make hay while the sun shines.
Right.
So the making hay while the sun shines impetus in a market economy is to make more of the product because the price is high, knowing that ultimately the price will come down, but meanwhile you've got a lot more hay in the barn. And so, you know, there's two ways to solve for it. The other one is to take money out of the pocket of the people who are bidding the price up so that it doesn't get bid up in the same way. Now, that happens naturally in the housing market, because when the mortgage rate goes up, then people are less inclined to buy houses. Houses aren't the same kind of necessity. If you're moving from house A to house B, if you already own a house,
right.
You already own a house.
Right.
You want to get into a more comfortable house, but a little discomfort not moving, that's a totally discretionary choice. So housing prices can be affected pretty quickly by the kind of economic factor of the interest rate going up. Tom, Dick, and Mary, most of what they buy, they have what's called price inelasticity. They need to buy it no matter what its price.
Right.
You got to buy food no matter what its price. You got to pay rent no matter what its price.
The refrigerator goes out. The washer, the dryer.
Yeah, those things are a little more discretionary. When they ultimately fail, you have to replace it. But I'm talking about the stuff you absolutely have to do tomorrow and day after tomorrow. And so when you start making it harder to do those things by taking money out of the pocket of the person who's paying for those things, if you take their ability to borrow money away from them, if you cause them to lose their jobs by a recession, then, of course, they're in a much more difficult plight. So the pain of the medicine for inflation is basically inflicted on Tom, Dick, and Mary.
All right. Listen, we've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams, and you. We'll be right back.